Chapter 4. Bodies Living. Souls slapping along. Feet flying beyond the striders and shufflers. It's good to run. Puffing lungs, cheeks hot in the wind. Berries. Swift fingers pluck. The hill now. Short legs fall behind. Until there, the dark skull eye of the rock, watching for the people. Tired, empty stomach, tall ones bend down, give a fat chew. Teeth work, copying the jaws all around the fire, circling to soften hides. Clear twilight, time to eat. Small hand still learning the cut chew, cut chew. And, like everything, marks are left behind on skin, enamel, bones. Then, overbright eyes full of hearth glow, lids droop, head sinks into a lap of dreams. Neanderthals have long held the title of most hench hominins. Though shorter than us, they weighed about 15% more, were bulkier, and had thicker, heavier bones. While far from hardcore bodybuilders, their bodies were strongly muscled. Traditionally, the explanation for this was basically ice ages. Since the 19th century, biologists have known that cold-adapted species, often in higher latitudes, tend to have larger bodies but shorter limbs. Such stumpy proportions mean less surface area and better heat retention. But seasonality is also involved. Body mass is linked to the length of the growing season, because this dictates food abundance and availability. And being bigger means creatures can have more fat stores for times when food is scarce. Living humans appear to roughly follow these geographic and seasonal bodily patterns, with Europeans tending to be stockier and have thicker bone shafts than those of African backgrounds. On the face of it, Neanderthals also fit the trend, and since initially their bones were mostly found in clearly glacial contexts, this idea was hugely influential. Long-lasting and severe bodily stress from living in cold conditions causes biochemical reactions that involve the production of growth hormones, and as we saw with noses, the majority of Neanderthal anatomical idiosyncrasies were long viewed through this lens. But robust bodies aren't unique to them, nor to cold climates. Older hominins, and even very early Homo sapiens, were sturdier and had thicker bones than living people. Moreover, recent research shows that Neanderthals' more compact size and shape would have brought barely 1 degree centigrade of extra cold resistance, and their large brain size doesn't fit a thermal trend either. To be fair, some 19th century scholars like biologist Thomas Huxley saw Neanderthal brawn not as a mirror of brutality, but resulting from highly mobile lifestyles. Backing up his prescient views, the past few decades have seen a significant shift towards more nuanced explanations, often thanks to anatomical research and biomechanical models. It's the impact of extremely demanding lives that's looking increasingly important. Neanderthals had to balance conflicting needs. More massive bodies coped better with their intensive lifestyles, but needed a lot of fuel. And extra calories require more oxygen to convert into energy. Therefore, respiratory efficiency became crucial, exemplified by huge noses siphoning in air and larger chests to accommodate more capacious lungs. Every breath they inhaled was deeper. Furthermore, experiments show that increased exercise makes not just the limbs of young animals more robust, but their whole bodies. Skulls get heavier, brow ridges larger, muscle attachments bigger. And body proportions change. Children growing up at high altitudes, whose metabolisms must work harder with reduced oxygen, can develop slightly shorter legs. That all sounds very familiar to what we see in Neanderthals. From finger to toe, Their skeletons show clear evidence for thicker bones and larger muscles, making them at least 10% beefier than even similarly stocky Homo sapiens populations. This was definitely genetic, since it's visible in babies, but even youngsters also had physically tough lives. Lemustier I's legs were already well developed before his teens because of enormous activity. Average Neanderthal leg-to-arm strength ratios were even greater than cross-country competitors running 160 kilometers or 100 miles per week. But it's not necessarily only about distance. Neanderthal relative limb bone thickness more closely resembles prehistoric and recent Homo sapiens populations, who habitually travelled over extremely rugged landscapes. And their strength wasn't only in legs, with arms as powerful as many of today's athletes. So, they had the bodies to cope with rough country, but climate is still likely part of the equation. It's becoming apparent that some complex feedback processes were at work in shaping Neanderthal bodies. Intensely active lifestyles in challenging landscapes with cold phases fine-tuning particular features. Adaptations developed during glacials might have persisted even during warmer times, sometimes helpfully, in other cases perhaps creating their own challenges. That Neanderthals moved around an awful lot has never really been controversial, but the manner in which they did so was often debated. The knuckle-dragger cliché was at the margins of discourse from the start, despite anatomical evidence since Spee in the 1880s that they walked as upright as we do. As well as the leg bones from Lemustier in 1907, a couple of years later, and just a few kilometres west, Peroni and Capitan uncovered the Laferrisse 1, or LF1, male skeleton. Still one of the most complete Neanderthal skeletons known, it was missing only a kneecap and small hand and foot bones. Though short at 1.6 metres, 5 foot 2 inches, he was beefy, weighing probably about 85 kilograms or 190 pounds, and patently a fully upright walker. But it was the La Chapelle-Ausson skeleton, found in 1908, that had huge influence. Boulle inaccurately reconstructed the legs and spine as stooped, and this image was then projected to millions via an illustrated reconstruction in 1909 that, down to the prehensile toes, was decidedly ape-like. Today, there's no question that Neanderthals were fully upright, but it's possible that walking alongside them might have left you slightly out of step. Some anatomical differences indicate a gait that wasn't identical to ours, and being shorter means they likely covered ground around 4-7% more slowly. However, recent biomechanical analyses don't point to drastically less efficient locomotion, especially when compared to roughly contemporary early hominins. On that basis, Neanderthal women used just 1 kilocalorie more energy when walking, and if their overall heavier bodies are taken into account, their legs come out more efficient. While an image of them as tireless striders fits the skeletal evidence, running doesn't seem to have been a Neanderthal forte. With reinforced foot arches to cope with their greater bulk, sprinting and especially endurance running would have been less efficient. Perhaps Neanderthals might have lost to any Homo sapiens in a 5,000-meter track race, but on the other hand, their Achilles tendons made them much more sure-footed on uneven ground. Biosocial beings. So far, Neanderthals seem to fall somewhere between hardcore hill walkers or trail sprinters. Huge lungs puffing, chunky thigh and calf muscles flexing as feet pound terrain. But what were those strapping arms all about? They had a seriously powerful wrist twist and would have made champion arm wrestlers. But most of the strength was in the upper arms, a pattern unlike any recent Homo sapiens populations. And there are interesting asymmetries. We know from lithics and wear patterns on their teeth that Neanderthals were right-handers like us, and the dominant side was between 25-60% more developed. That's close to what we see in cricketers or tennis players and imply strenuous habitual activity, often assumed to be spear hunting. Fossils include 200,000-year-old isolated arm from Torvy-la-Rivière, France. Confirm that some Neanderthals were making upwards and rotating movements similar to throwing, and as we'll see later, actual javelin-like spears are preserved. But overall, their shoulder mechanics aren't as well suited to overarm movement as ours. And the asymmetric patterns in arm muscle development also don't match this. Another possibility exists. Electrode monitoring experiments reveal a better match for Neanderthal-style muscle flexing that's not spearing, but one-handed scraping. We know they were scraping a number of materials, including wood, but the working of animal skins may have been the main task causing their right arm asymmetry. Chapter 10 explores in detail what we know about Neanderthal hide working, but fundamentally, it's very intensive work. Each animal skin can require more than 10 hours of scraping in multiple phases, and so even if they only processed half the hides they obtained, a Neanderthal might end up doing 100 hours of scraping annually. However, the electrode experiments threw up something else. It turns out that when spearing, it's not the dominant elbow joint that takes the strain, but the opposite one, as it helps guide the shaft. Exactly this pattern of left elbow asymmetry is seen in Neanderthals, caused by huge tension while the arm was straight and extended. So, their bodies may well record hunting, but in an unexpected way. Should you pluck up the courage to offer your hand to a Neanderthal, would it be crushed? Only if they chose. Differences in bone anatomy and significant hand muscles gave them formidable power, but without sacrificing dexterity. Recent analysis doesn't support claims that they were less nimble-fingered, but their hands do seem built for dealing with massive forces and transmitting them into the arm. They possessed huge strength when grasping in the palm, and big muscles combined with large finger tendons ensured a steely grip. Their odd-looking wide fingertips, probably visible in the flesh, were likely adapted to hold things extremely tightly, with only a minimal loss of precision for very fiddly tasks. Biomechanics suggests that it might have been napping driving at least some of these anatomical features. The base of the thumb comes under greatest strain, matching exactly where their anatomy was suited to coping with strong forces. And when using lithic tools, it's the outer edges of the thumb and fingers that need to be strong, again mirroring their hand anatomy. Even if their deft fingertip manipulation may have been marginally less than our own, the archaeology shows that they were perfectly able to make and use miniaturized artifacts. It may be that the greater finger grip strength and thumb flex compensated, allowing them to tightly hold teeny things. But individual Neanderthals show variation, potentially related to lifetimes of doing different tasks. Biosocial archaeology explores skeletons according to age and sex as a means to work out patterns in who did what. La Ferracie II is especially well studied as one of few relatively complete skeletons identified as female. Well, probably female. Sex identification relies on shape and relative sizes of particular bones like the pelvis. One of the most complete and famous females was found in 1932 at Et Tabun Cave, Mount Carmel, in then Palestine. In remarkable serendipity, three women archaeologists were involved in unearthing her bones. The first fingers to touch Tabun I, holding up a tooth to the sun, belonged to Yusra, a local expert field worker. Working alongside her was Jaquetta Hawkes, newly graduated archaeologist invited to the Tabun excavation by its director, eminent prehistorian Dorothy Garrod. Sex identification isn't 100% certain without DNA testing, which has yet to be done on any Neanderthals from the Near East, but assessments of how less heavily built a skeleton is can also help. Found just 50 centimetres, 20 inches away, from LF1, LF2 is also obviously adult, but clearly much less robust. Even so, the average size difference between living men and women is pretty similar to what we can perceive in Neanderthals. European males bulked out between 77 and 85 kilograms, 170 and 190 pounds. Females, 63 and 69 kilograms, or 140 and 150 pounds. Also, like us, sometimes Neanderthal men and women tended to use their bodies differently. Legs overall were equally strong, but women showed some asymmetry, with more buff thighs than lower legs. Differences in the amount of walking versus running might explain this, connected to the sort of terrain covered, but it's hard to model specifics. There's also sex dissimilarity between upper and lower arm bones. LF2's biceps probably weren't as strong as the average Neanderthal man. Or perhaps surprisingly, even women from a range of Homo sapiens populations. But her lower arm had a strength measure more extreme than any comparative group. This must reflect repeated, particular actions, but intriguingly, in general, Neanderthal women don't display asymmetry between right and left arms, like the men. Whatever they were doing with their lower arms, it mostly involved both hands. Double-handed hide working is a distinct possibility, potentially during a particular preparation phase based on studies of some hunter-gatherer women. Another part of the body with interesting stories to tell is teeth. Crucial for working out age, they also record how their owners used their mouths for things other than gnawing or chewing. In many cultures where only a knife is used to eat, people slice off choice chunks while holding the food in their mouth. As the edge drags against enamel, particularly with a stone tool, minute scratches get left on the teeth. Such marks are visible in Neanderthals and provide key evidence for rates of handedness, but also social differences. Recent work comparing adults by sex, including some from El Cidron, found that scratches tend to be more numerous and longer in Neanderthal women. Other dental stigmata exist too. Think how useful your teeth can be, tugging at an especially tight knot or carrying things when hands are full. Ethnographic data tells us that mouths can be vital tools either to hold or process things by masticating. This might be animal products like sinew or plant materials. It's long been obvious that Neanderthals' front teeth are extremely worn from use like this, even exposing dentine. In particular, they seem to resemble hunter-gatherer societies that used their mouths for hide working, clenching the teeth like a vise through which to drag the hide and soften it up, or process sinews. There are also sex differences here. Some women seem to have much more intensively worn front teeth. The closest match is historic Arctic hunter-gatherer societies, such as the Inuit, Yupik, Chukchi, or Inupiat, where women spent much of their time working hides. However, the pattern isn't identical. Neanderthal women were using their upper front teeth far more, and lacked heavily worn back teeth from chewing skins. Either they had a very particular method, or there was another task happening that is as yet unidentifiable. To add to the impression that some tasks tended to be done by one sex more than another, Neanderthal women have a higher frequency of chipping damage on their lower front teeth, while in men it's on the upper set. There aren't any ethnographic clues for how these particular asymmetries were produced, but since these patterns are roughly similar across Western European sites, we might be looking at widespread commonalities in activity organisation. A note of caution is needed, however, since the sample size for female skeletons is limited, plus the way we interpret things can be tinged with bias. For some, it's easier to imagine Neanderthal women working hides than the possibility that asymmetry in men's arms might be better explained by one-handed scraping rather than spearing. Moreover, we have little idea how they defined their own categories of gender, which goes beyond the spectrum of biological sex variation. Their social distinctions need not have been binary, nor mapped directly onto anatomy. Certainly, childbearers carried, literally, an extra lifetime's biological load, some of which might be possible to tease out from the bones. Maybe some of the locomotion differences in women came from routinely carrying youngsters, and a good proportion of the hide working that left its mark on arms and teeth was probably for children's clothing and wraps to carry infants. Just like living people, however, individuality shines through. Some Neanderthals enjoyed or were better at particular tasks than others. They would have been likely to do those more often, creating the conditions for proto-craft specialists to emerge. Highly unusual tooth damage may reflect this. One man from Lochtus Cave, France, had abnormally intense chipping on just one of his front teeth from use over a long time period. Meanwhile, the El Cidrón One man had major damage, but on both front teeth. It's not clear what caused this. Retouching lithics by biting is one possibility, since, while sounding unlikely, it's known from a few hunter-gatherer cultures. Probably the most numerous social category in any Neanderthal group was children. Born stronger than us, intense activity further toughened their little bodies. Even before the age of 10, in Uzbekistan, the Teshiktash child's legs must have walked huge amounts, while Lemustier I's teenage arms were almost as muscly as an adult's. Youngsters' teeth also show them practicing or joining in with adult tasks. At Cima de los Huesos, older children and teenagers had already begun to wear off their enamel. But even the littlest ones here and elsewhere have some distinctive clamping wear, suggesting that hide working was one thing they started to help with early on. Overall, children's tooth microwear increases with age, but it's more complex than just greater amounts of mouth use. Micro scratches in the young boy from El Cidrón were not only fewer but also diagonal rather than vertical. This means he had learned to eat like a grown-up using a lithic, but wasn't really doing a lot of other tasks with his mouth. There's a hint of the social settings where he and other children may have been learning and copying. Since their overall tooth damage pattern on average resembles women's more than men's. Neanderthal children certainly learned by doing, and from birth had front row seats for most of the tasks they needed to master as adults. Whether slicing fat off muscle, eating around a hearth, or walking the land. There was probably some teaching for particularly complicated things, but Western standards of appropriate child safety and supervision aren't shared by all societies. In many hunter-gatherer cultures, youngsters will play with sharp tools, sometimes wielding them even before they can walk, and independently forage together. But busy childhoods brought with them a high cost, which some of the youngest paid.
Burdens in the bones. Had the 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes known about Neanderthals, he would have undoubtedly included them in his famous description of hunter-gatherers as having poor, nasty, brutish and short lives, in continual fear and danger of violent death. This prejudice has often been applied to Neanderthals and hominins, but drew extra support from their own bodies. Most complete skeletons bear marks of at least one affliction, whether illness or injury, and sometimes a veritable series of unfortunate events befell them. Yet, at the same time, modern research is tending to show that while Neanderthals certainly had it tough, it wasn't necessarily worse than for other humans living in such challenging environments. A case in point concerns teeth growth interruption lines, quite common in Neanderthals and long claimed to show they suffered periods of childhood starvation. All the El Cidrón individuals had them, formed from toddlerhood to about 4 and even as late as 12 years old. Some there and elsewhere like Lemustier I have multiple such phases. But it's not universal and others had none. Better biomedical understanding now suggests that while they can be due to malnutrition, mostly they record systemic bodily stress, such as serious viral illness or infection. Moreover, Neanderthals weren't more afflicted than other human groups. Samples from prehistoric Inuit sites show longer-lasting series of lines from early childhood, whereas Neanderthal children seem to be affected from toddlerhood onwards. This is perhaps related to the introduction of solid foods, a classic time for more exposure to germs. Interestingly, early Homo sapiens samples show more lines in young babies, which could point to even greater health stress than Neanderthal infants suffered. Even without growth lines, it's safe to say that most Neanderthals could have done with a visit to the dentist. Like many prehistoric societies, poor oral health was common, and many must have been in varying amounts of pain from extreme tooth wear. Heavy calculus caused receding gums, trapped food, and eventually led to abscesses in some individuals. Microwear scratches on one young adult from El Cidron show over time that he switched his preferred hand for eating, potentially connected to a nasty root abscess. Others suffered development conditions. Lemoustier I had an unerupted canine tooth, and an unfortunate individual from Crepina had two malpositioned back teeth, one of which was impacted and probably very painful. Yet, like us, Neanderthals tried to be their own hygienists. Distinctive grooves show that some practice habitual toothpicking, especially on sore areas. Rates differ between sites, however, potentially indicating varying states of health or perhaps even social traditions. The chances of archaeologists finding actual toothpicks seems infinitesimal, yet at El Cidron, a conifer wood fragment was embedded in calculus right next to a tooth with pick grooves. 21st century analysis can even reveal things that aren't visible on bones. Again at El Cidron, DNA in calculus came from a gut parasite that causes nasty diarrhea. Overall, while they don't appear especially sickly compared to other hunter-gatherers, Neanderthals endured a smorgasbord of other health problems. Some conditions are actually rare today. The Zeeland Ridges skull fragment is the only truly submarine Neanderthal yet found and bears the mark of a genetic condition. Dredged up in 2001 from some 30 metres or 100 feet deep, 15 kilometres or 10 miles offshore from the Netherlands, a large ulcer caused by a deep cyst is clear. Certainly visible during life, it may have caused its bear a little bother, but such ulcers can lead to problems with balance and headaches, or more seriously, bleeding on the brain, convulsions and seizures. Other conditions which today have varying symptoms are seen in multiple Neanderthals. Three individuals, two from the same site, bear distinctive bony growths on the spine and elsewhere. They may have been pain-free or caused backache, mobility problems, or even the seizing up of joints entirely. Interestingly, it's most common today in males and connected to meat and fat-rich diets seen in historical cases, including the Renaissance Medici dynasty of Florence, Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II, and medieval monks and merchants who enjoyed high-calorie food. Several Neanderthals elsewhere had different bone growths on the skull. Probably caused by hormones including higher estrogen levels, it can lead to headaches, thyroid issues, and substantial weight gain. Older women have a higher lifetime exposure to estrogen, perhaps explaining why we see it on the Forbes Quarry skull from Gibraltar, which belonged to a woman aged at least 40. But men with low testosterone are also at risk, putting the two known male Neanderthal sufferers in company with the 18th century castrato singer Farinelli and modern prostate cancer patients. Despite common belief that Neanderthals barely made it past their 20s, the Forbes woman is among a number of middle-aged or older Neanderthals. Even if they grew slightly faster as children, this would have had a minimal impact on total lifespan. So biologically, there's no reason septuagenarian Neanderthals couldn't have huddled by hearths. The apparent rarity of individuals over 50 is common across the archaeological record of all periods. since accurately identifying age beyond that is tricky, and elderly bones tend to be more fragile. So, what did decades of hard living, Neanderthal style, do to you? An especially famous old geezer lived at Shkaft Mazin Shanidar, Great Shanidar Rock Shelter, Iraqi Kurdistan. Initially dug between 1951 and 1960 and currently being reinvestigated, this truly spectacular site produced more than 10 mostly complete skeletons. The very first found, known as Shanidar 1, was probably well into middle age and had overcome an astonishing number of physical difficulties. Sometime before adulthood, his right upper arm suffered a terrible multiple fracture and shriveled after healing badly. Incredibly, it looks as if the lower part was amputated, presumably by someone else. While he survived and coped with these injuries, his right shoulder blade was malformed, and it may also have led to his collarbone being both unusually small and developing a serious bacterial infection, perhaps also damaged during the original injury. But his troubles didn't end there. He had one of those probably painful bony growth conditions and poor hearing that meant he most likely found it hard to follow his fellow's communication. To top everything off, he also survived multiple head injuries. A horrendous wound crushed the upper left side of his face, distorting the bone all around his eye and cheek. This may have been the same dreadful event that fractured his arm, but several other blows heavy enough to affect the bone definitely happened at later times. Whenever it took place, the large injury left him not only with massive soft tissue damage, but probably also partially sighted, if not blind, in one eye. In spite of living with chronic pain and his many challenges, Shanidar 1 adapted to daily life in the group. He continued to use his dominant arm despite missing a hand, perhaps even napping using an altered technique. Though by death he displayed a marked limp from advanced arthritis, well-developed leg bones point to an adulthood just as mobile as other Neanderthals. After coming through so much, however, slower reactions may have been his ultimate downfall, since some evidence points to him being caught in a rockfall. Shanidar 1 is the most battered Neanderthal known, but he's far from alone in having endured more than one physical complaint. Decades before his discovery, another skeleton had earned the moniker Old Man. Just 4 days before Lemoustier 1's skull was finally removed in 1908, three priests who shared an enthusiasm for prehistory were surveying caves near La Chapelle-aux-Saints in Corrèze. Within one cavity, set like an eye socket in a low hill, they exposed a body lying on its side, knees drawn up. Buzzing with adrenaline at their astonishing luck, they rapidly exhumed and packed up the remains before writing for advice the same night to eminent scholars. Boulle stepped up, and the remains were sent to his laboratory. Upon their arrival, the true significance of the La Chapelle-aux-Saints skeleton as the first, almost complete Neanderthal was clear. Though slightly younger than Shanidar 1, nonetheless, a hard life was etched into the old man's bones. In addition to similar hearing loss, massive dental wear made him prone to excruciating abscesses, and about half his teeth were gone, extreme even for older hunter-gatherers. Bone degeneration, which eventually would have made walking painful, is visible across his body. While some was perhaps due to injuries, much resulted from routine massive exertion, probably hauling heavy loads of stone or animal carcasses. On the other hand, unlike Shanidar 1 and other Neanderthals, his only clear injury was a long-heeled broken rib. In fact, a contrast could easily be made with La Pharasie 1, who was also lying in Boulle's laboratory at the same time. Probably younger than the old man, at between 45 to 50 years old, LF1 had suffered more injuries, though fewer than Shanidar 1. Relatively common today and not especially severe was a fractured collarbone, perhaps leaving his shoulder somewhat lopsided and affecting arm use. But more seriously, LF1 had broken the top of his thigh bone in the hip joint. Such an injury is quite rare and usually caused by a heavy fall while the leg is twisting. Maybe muddy ground while LF1 was hunting turned a slip into something more dangerous. Or perhaps he was even knocked over by the quarry itself. In any case, we know it happened decades before he died. And he never walked the same, eventually curving his spine. Extra discomfort came later from arthritis, followed by a serious condition causing agonizing swelling of joints, fingertips, and toes. By his end, LF1 may have been in permanent pain. Perhaps it's not surprising that some older Neanderthals weathered wretched health. But more unexpected are quite severe injuries in some juveniles. Lemoustier-1 is a case in point. He sustained a nasty broken jaw that healed badly and probably caused asymmetric wear on his teeth from prolonged difficulty eating. As well as potentially affecting verbal communication, this tells us it happened sometime well before his death at between 11 and 15 years old. And even younger children were battered about. Less than a kilometre from Forbes Quarry in Gibraltar is the Devil's Tower Fisher Site, explored in 1925 by a young Dorothy Garrod. What she found nearly a decade before she excavated Taboon 1 was the remains of a child no more than 5 years old with a broken jaw. Even more shocking, it had happened at least a couple of years before, and he had also sustained later potentially fatal skull fractures. Would such a young child have been involved in risky activities like hunting, or are we looking at accidents while unsupervised? Two serious injuries seems particularly unlucky. The other possibility, of course, is that somebody hit him. The risk of injury and death would be amplified if the danger came from within. Pernicious beliefs that Neanderthals were prone to violence have persisted. However, unambiguous evidence of assaults is rare. There is quite a high rate of head injuries, but in almost all cases it's uncertain how they were inflicted. Medical research shows that blows from fighting tend to either be facial or land above the level of the ears. And since 90% of perpetrators will be right-handed, they're almost always on the left side. Among various head injuries at the Cima de los Huesos, one individual stands out, having been struck twice with the same object from different angles. That's hard to explain accidentally, but the weapon could have been a hoof rather than a hand axe. The sheer size of Shanidar 1's massive injury means he was either battered by something enormous or struck many times. Similarly, a skull fragment from Krapina bears a gigantic sunken fracture just behind the right ear. This is the most serious cranial trauma known in any fossil hominin, but it's actually too big for most assault injuries, far larger than typically caused by hand-wielded weapons. Remarkably, this grave injury eventually healed, although the skull's owner may have been left with brain injuries and their long-term impacts. Overall, Neanderthals at Krapina do have quite a high rate of crushed skull injuries, some showing massive inflammation, but few are in the assault zone. Accidents do seem likely explanations for most, which actually matches what we know from some hunter-gatherer populations, where falls commonly cause serious injuries. Out of thousands of fossils, there are only two strong cases for Neanderthal or Neanderthal assault. One is another Shanidar adult whose chest was stabbed so deeply the wound slashed across two ribs, yet they survived. The ribs healed and, remarkably, grew around part of the weapon that remained inside. Based on the shape of the gap, this would match a lithic flake or point. Nonetheless, it's just possible a terrible accident rather than intent was the cause. Perhaps during the last frantic seconds of a hunt, a spear thrust brought down not the beast, but a fellow hunter. The final example, however, is really beyond reasonable doubt. In the late 1960s, partial remains of a Neanderthal that we'll hear much more about in Chapter 15 were excavated at La Roche à Pierrot near Saint-Césaire, southwest France. Probably a woman, 3D reconstruction of her skull revealed that what seemed at first to be a warped fragment edge was actually part of an appalling wound over 7 centimetres, or 2.7 inches long. It was located right on the top of the skull, and in forensic terms closely resembles injuries from sharp, straight-edged objects. This mystery object struck the Saint-Césaire woman's head, either from in front or behind, so violently her scalp ruptured and bone beneath shattered. Yet again, however, traces of healing show that even such violent trauma was survived. So, at least some violence was happening. Does that mean Neanderthals were routinely murderous? Probably not. Sick or injured Neanderthals may have been more likely to die in rock shelters and caves, and therefore end up preserved, while living in such places might itself have been a hazard. Miners, for example, had high rates of head injuries until safety reforms brought in protective headgear. Neanderthals weren't tunnelling with explosives, but they were lighting fires beneath stone ceilings, causing rapid thermal changes that make rockfalls a real risk. Looking at large samples also shows that severe injuries weren't universal. From 279 upper limb parts at Crepina, just 3 arm bones and 1 collarbone are damaged. None of the 170 plus leg bones are affected. Certainly, older Neanderthals everywhere indicate that health got worse with age, but that's common to all humans living tough lives. Moreover, comparing early Homo sapiens sites is informative. The site of Nadec, Czech Republic, produced remains of at least 9 people dating around 36,000 years ago, just a few millennia after the last known Neanderthals. Nearly all had poor health indicators, whether severe growth interruption lines on teeth, hearing impairment or deafness, infections, a benign tumour, bone degeneration, gum disease, and potentially scurvy or meningitis. In addition to a broken arm, a single male skull known as Mladec I bore 3 injuries, very likely from assault. Farther east and a few thousand years later, at Sungir, Russia, there's even a cut-and-dried Homo sapiens murder case. The throat of a richly buried adult skeleton had been violently gashed, very probably fatally. Youth for early Homo sapiens people wasn't any less tough than for Neanderthals either. Another spectacular burial at Sungir is of 2 children buried head-to-head. Both had more than 1 phase of tooth growth interruptions, and 1's thigh bones were extremely short and bowed, probably from a genetic condition. The other's facial bones were also abnormal and probably made eating difficult. They had no tooth wear, suggesting that special soft foods were provided. We can even find a match for the battered little devil's tower boy in the early Homo sapiens skeleton of a 4 to 5-year-old at Lagar Velho, Portugal. As a toddler, he had suffered a severe facial blow and a healed serious arm injury. On balance, we may actually come out as more violent than Neanderthals, because nowhere is there evidence they killed youngsters. That's not the case at the early Homo sapiens site of Balzirossi, northwest Italy, where a child very probably perished after being stabbed or shot in the back. A stone tool fragment was still lodged in 1 vertebra. And while it's possibly some kind of horrific accident, the weight points towards social conflict. Such aggression in our own species, even between hunter-gatherers, is certainly well documented and clearly accelerated over the past 40,000 years. In contrast, we see no such phenomenon through the hundreds of millennia Neanderthals existed. Many lands, many lives. The bones of each and every Neanderthal hold unique stories. At grand scales across regions or through geological time, there are subtle anatomical differences. 2 Neanderthal infants born probably 30,000 years and thousands of kilometres apart, Lemoustier II in France and Mesmaskaya I in Russia, shared distinctively thick bones. But in other ways, such as arm proportions, they were slightly dissimilar. And even Neanderthals who lived in the same areas at roughly similar times were far from clones. Variations in bodily form that appear more common in some times and places are visible in adults too. For example, Northern European Neanderthals' faces stuck out a bit more, giving them larger gaps behind the back teeth. And between Le Moustier 1 and the Crepina Neanderthals, living hundreds of kilometres and around 80,000 to 90,000 years apart, there are small but noticeable dental differences. In some places, we can see highly localised anatomical foibles. At La Quina, southwest France, three adults and a teenager all share a particular skull feature that's very rare elsewhere. This implies long-term processes where subpopulations became genetically isolated enough that random mutations were distilled, just as happens in people today for various reasons. The La Quina Neanderthals lived at the end of an intense glaciation, which may have shrunk populations, causing isolation and high levels of inbreeding. Sometimes, regional climate might have directly influenced anatomy. Southern European Neanderthals were, to some degree, insulated from the cold, although not always from aridity. And strikingly, those from the Near East have less heavily built, thinner bodies. But if Neanderthal physique was affected by physical activity, this difference might also be reflecting how local ecology influenced levels of mobility. That's backed up by recent studies on limbs. While males from Europe had more developed lower legs, those in the Near East had stronger thighs, pointing to variations in either how much they moved around, or the kind of terrain. In women, although the sample size is very small, the difference is even greater. But both men and women from the Near East had beefier arms. Tooth anatomy itself doesn't show clear regional trends, but wear patterns definitely do. More than 40 Neanderthals at over 20 sites, ranging from Pont-Nawith, Wales to Shanidar, Iraq, clearly show that the environment affected not only what they ate, but how they used their mouths as tools. Those from regions or periods with more open vegetation like steppe had higher levels of tooth clamping. The most obvious reason may be that Neanderthals in colder conditions needed more clothing and spent much more time working animal hide. There are smaller scale patterns, however, that are harder to tease out, but which could mark regional traditions in technology or tasks. In particular, Italian Neanderthals have more wear than Western Europeans. And strikingly, after 60,000 years ago, no Near Eastern Neanderthals display this type of wear at all. Combined with the evidence from limbs, it suggests that those living in this warm, arid, but plant-rich area hunted, foraged and processed materials in unique ways. But there are always exceptions. Some individuals from warmer and more vegetated environments were using their mouths in ways that look exactly like others from steppe tundra contexts. Perhaps in clement conditions, when they were under less intense survival pressure, Neanderthals were more likely to diversify their skills, with their bodies taking on the imprint of their craft expertise. The earthly remains of Neanderthals have furnished us with the most remarkable, intimate details about their lives. Each dawn brought a new day of arduous work, but their existence wasn't, for the most part, more challenging than typical hunting and gathering peoples. They knew both pains and pleasures, great and small. Long-distance trekkers, they ate up tough terrain despite a short stride. Their arms and hands were immensely strong, yet capable of fine dexterity. And just like us, there were many ways to be a Neanderthal. A walking tour of their world would have meant meeting groups who looked and probably sounded quite different, whose idea of normal life might have been just as unfamiliar to each other as to us. Moreover, within their biological diversity, every individual took their own path. As ancient genetics develops further, mechanisms and adaptations behind Neanderthals' unique biology will become clearer. But perhaps the biggest revolution has been the toppling of Ice Age explanations for why they looked and lived how they did. Their bodies were honed for and by hugely demanding lifestyles, whether or not they hunched against glacial winds. Living through extreme cold climates may have simply buffed up the already sleek engine they ran on. And when we fully survey the vast swathe of climates and environments that Neanderthals experienced, their story becomes even more unexpected.